What you are about to hear is the story of a connection that was made between a television series and a viewer's life. Our television set sits in the corner of our living room, befriending us, educating us, inspiring us, making us laugh or cry or tear our hair out in frustration. It is a far more constant companion than most of the friends we will ever make, or even our family. The You and Who books are the story of that companionship, that connection, as told by the people who watch the programmes that make us come alive, chiefly, of course, Doctor Who. This podcast will relate some of those stories. You're listening to You and Who Talking, and I'm J.R. Southall, the creator and chief editor of the series.
Aliens in the Dark Waters, The Pescatons by Lee Rawlings, 41, Devon, UK. First story, The Robots of Death. I love a good lighthouse, me. I love its tall, lonely disposition. I love the way it swings its powerfully bright arm, slicing through the inky black night. I love its monstrous heart-stopping foghorn. I love the romantic side of a very practical and brilliant piece of engineering. I adore the thrilling stories of brave keepers in amidst the mindless might of an uncaring ocean on a stormy night, duty-bound to help the safety of ships heading to their destinations. I love the fact that this simple idea has saved millions of lives and that the people that used to keep them going were hardy, honest, hard-working men with many a good story to tell. I read Tony Parker's book, Lighthouse, 20 years ago, a slice of human social history captured before the lights became automated, and I love every salty page of it. A long time ago, I even applied to become a lighthouse keeper, but I didn't get as far as an interview. I was never told why. Maybe Trinity House had spotted in my application that my personality simply wouldn't suit the three-month-on, three-month-off job, dashing my hopes of becoming an assistant keeper at a land lighthouse on the south coast of England back in the 80s. Maybe I was too young. I was 18 at the time. Who knows? I've always loved lighthouses, even to the point of nearly considering remortgaging the house and buying Hartland Point Lighthouse in North Devon for £500,000, the only barrier being my family. Whenever I go on holiday to coastal Britain, I look for a lighthouse to visit, whether it be a heritage centre like the Lizard Lighthouse at Britain's most southerly point, or all of the lighthouses on the Isle of Mull in the Western Isles of Scotland. The former is a particular favourite of mine. In fact, as I write this article, I am 3 miles from the Lizard Peninsula, having visited it earlier today to meet the former keeper Eddie, but with great disappointment and sadness, I find that Eddie is no longer available to talk to, owing to his Alzheimer's. I talked to him 6 years ago, and I said I would interview him for my local radio station, but I could never find the time. This has taught me to strike while the iron is hot. I should have driven down to Cornwall and spent a day with him. I will always regret that. Just like the time I was told not to bother going to see John Pertwee at the Devil's End reunion by a friend, as it would be a rip-off and seen as a bit sad. Idiot head here listened to him, and not my instincts. He's no longer a friend, by the way. Why do I have such an intense fascination with lighthouses and rough, dangerous waters? I can probably narrow it down to 2 experiences, watching Horror of Fang Rock and listening to The Pescatons on audio cassette. Fang Rock, that Tom Baker horror B-movie adventure from the 70s, set in the early 20th century and drenched in atmosphere. It captured my imagination and scared the hell out of me as a 7-year-old kid. The Pescatons carried on fulfilling my watery fascination with aliens coming out of the water and attacking humans without care. Both had me transfixed and sent my imaginations running. I've never really thought about the fact that it was sitting down on Saturday night with my family being petrified for 4 weeks running that may have been the catalyst for my passion of all things lighthouse. And that listening to the wails and screams of Londoners running away from scaly sharks on 2 legs with bulbous eyes cemented my love and fear of dark waters. Recently, I listened to a podcast waxing lyrical about the horror of Fang Rock, and as I was listening to this, I was writing a short audio play in the style of an American old-time radio show, Weirdly enough, my story had a lighthouse in it, and, you guessed it, monsters from the sea. At that point, I really started wondering why I liked these things so much, and I came to the inevitable conclusion it had to be these two stories. I remember watching Blue Peter in the 80s, and their terrifying attempts to land on a rock lighthouse straddling the rough and treacherous sea, and I was thinking, how would you escape that place if a shape-shifting alien was crawling up the spiral staircase towards you? Was I the only person thinking that? And the first time I was walking along the banks of the Thames, I was imagining creatures emerging from the depths to attack the innocent bystanders eating their chips and beer. In fact, that happens every time I'm next to the Thames at night, and I imagine different creatures with different motives crawling up from the slimy bed of that dank, dirty river. The Loch Ness Monster and the Daleks have enjoyed a swim in our most famous estuaries, and they are remembered fondly by the public and Who fans alike, but the humble Pescatons get forgotten, and I think it's time for a return. Moffat needs to bring back these monsters, simply because they suit his new brand of horror. It worked in Vampires of Venice, and it could work much better in the Thames at night. Go on, Moff. It would be a neat and damn scary story, I'm sure. Read some H.P. Lovecraft for inspiration, if that'll help. Talking of horror, nothing has replaced my fear of listening to the Pescatons in a darkened room as a kid through the wall of my brother's bedroom. Tom's somber voice, that terrifying music and the already mentioned screams and shrieks of the monsters themselves were enough to give me nightmares and keep me pinned to my bed, sweating with terror for the duration of that recording. Like Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, I found these audio stories gripping, scary and utterly addictive. I remember sneaking into my brother's bedroom when he was out and firstly being hit by the smell of humble paint. He was an avid wargamer, and these paints in tiny metal tins were used to colour various armies made of lead and tin, and they had a smell you couldn't get rid of out of your nose for hours. I found the Pescatons tape and played it. I don't know what was scarier, the recording or my brother going ape at me for not asking permission to enter his domain in the first place. Between these two very different but similarly themed stories, I have found A Haunting Dark Sea a bewitching one. Whether it be on the deck of a cruise liner in Alaska at midnight in the fog out on the open ocean, or standing on the southernmost cliff edge of Britain, watching a silent but visually stunning 26-mile lizard light swing overhead, razor sharp, cutting through a blanket of idle stars and skimming the turbulent crashing waves of the Cornish Sea, or even sitting with a single malt whiskey, watching the hypnotising movement of the wake of a party boat, breaking the reflection of the London Eye's overbright lights on the Thames, I find myself feeling, still after all these years, slightly perturbed, watching, hoping, and imagining what could be lurking in the murky, watery depths. Could there really be aliens in the dark waters?
And you're listening to You and Who Talking, episode number 3. Hello, JR, how are you?
I'm good, Rob, I'm good. It's sunny here, which will probably date this recording for a lot of people, because there won't be much sun in the UK.
Yes, people will always remember where they were the day it was sunny in the UK. Much like when Kennedy was shot and so on. We've just heard from Lee Rawlings talking about Doctor Who and the Pescatons, and who knew Lee was so into lighthouses?
I know, he's a bit... Well, actually, no, I'm not sure. I think Lee's into just about everything, actually, so lighthouses was bound to feature in there somewhere.
Yeah, no, I was really interested in hearing about that, and I think this is the beauty of You and Who. You get these insights into people that I would have never known he applied to be a lighthouse keeper or assistant lighthouse keeper when he was 18, for example.
Yeah, that was the... You know, obviously I've read this essay probably two or three times, and then listening back to this before recording, I was like, oh yeah, he actually applied to go and live on a lighthouse, and I think is a very good chance that the people who listen to the Blue Box podcast probably wish he had been successful in that.
Yeah, look, I thought it was a great essay. I really, really enjoyed hearing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's another great one to come.
There certainly is. We've got Jenny Shirt now about to talk about Sapphire and Steel and her relationship with that. And JR, I have a confession to make. never seen Sapphire and Steel.
Well, I'm not that surprised, to be honest. It's a bit of an acquired taste, and I don't think it travels too well. I think it's one of those things, if you saw it when you were a kid, well, either you'll have found it extremely dull, or else you'll absolutely love it. But I don't think it's the kind of thing that's likely to have shown up on television elsewhere. It's one of those really quirky series. It's amazing it even got made, if you look at it, especially as it's ITV, so it's commercial television. It's just such a really odd programme.
Yeah, look, I've read about it, obviously, in later years. When I was a kid, I remember Kmart got in this one year, this job lot of annuals. They must have got them from a UK distributor or something. And there was an annual for Sapphire and Steel and an annual for Manimal and some Doctor Who annuals. And they had this big pile of annuals they were selling for like a dollar each. And I remember seeing Sapphire and Steel then and clocking in my head, oh, that's Sapphire and Steel. I don't know what that's about. And it stuck with me ever since, but I've never actually seen it. So maybe I should dig it out and have a look at it, because everyone, well, not everyone, but a lot of people I know in Doctor Who fandom does actually talk about it.
Yeah, it is one of those big things. And of course, the other thing about Jenny's reading that we're about to hear is it's the first non-Doctor Who one we've had.
Indeed.
And that is, of course, going to be a thing over the weeks, is that we are going to occasionally feature essays that won't be about Doctor Who.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not directly about Doctor Who, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Mostly from Doctor Who fans, they'll be, regardless, yes.
Exactly. All right, shall we listen to Jenny's essay?
Let's have a listen.
Cracks in Time, Faceless People and Ghosts. Sapphire and Steel have been assigned. Sapphire and Steel by Jenny Shirt, 43, Manchester. Favourite TV programme, Doctor Who. Sapphire and Steel and Doctor Who are two of my favourite programmes, and each has at one time or another focused on time agents and time travel. Both had characters trying to solve temporal problems that could not be fixed by ordinary means, and they each involved travelling in time according to rules that were not meant to be broken. New and old objects became triggers, from which dark creatures from the beginning of time, the end of time, and even from time itself could break through. A menacing and oppressive atmosphere, together with Sapphire and Steel's powers, and other assigned elements brought in to assist the duo, made for a great series of stories. Their slight coldness, together with a disregard for the safety of the humans that got in the way of them being able to repair the fractures in time, all created the ideal recipe for avid telly-watching. I remember a visit to an old country house after watching the complete series. Walking down the corridor, we came to a nursery, and entering the room I felt an immediate drop in temperature to freezing cold. Now, whether this was just because of the lack of radiators or due to my very vivid imagination, who knows? On the walls there were portraits of the house and its old residents. This led me to think of the fattest man in one of the assignments imprisoning a person inside a photograph and eventually setting it alight. There was nothing that could be done to save the human trapped inside. To my young eyes, this had a very claustrophobic feel and was horrific to watch. It stayed with me. To this day, the huge family portraits where the eyes follow you around a room really make the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. I imagine the faceless man all over again. Sapphire and Steel was quite dark in parts. They couldn't save everyone. They didn't care that much, and they really only focused on the assignments in hand, on being there to fix the cracks in time. Were they really aliens, time agents, elements, or a combination of all these things? The one thing that shone through was their lack of empathy towards any humans they encountered along the way. Sapphire and Steel was quite disturbing at the time, but that's why it worked. The one story that haunted me more than any other was set on a lonely station platform. The whispers, time manifesting itself as a creeping darkness slowly approaching and feeding off the resentment of people. The ghostly soldier standing on that lonely platform seeking revenge, an image that burned itself into my mind. Sapphire attempts to contact the entity, which leads to a personality change. Possessed by the darkness, she tries to kill Steel with a bunch of flowers. Why is time fracturing? What is the reason for it? This is something that is never revealed, and it doesn't have to be. It just works. Time used objects as a door for evil to get through. A photograph, a piece of cloth maybe. Sapphire and Steel were the ones assigned. They also had powers. Sapphire could turn back time for a moment, and Steel could freeze his body temperature to zero. We never found out who the duo were. Human or alien, it didn't matter. To me, they were fascinating. I remember going to an old mill a few years back for Halloween, as there was an immersive play taking place that night, with the mill plunged into darkness, creating a really creepy atmosphere. The story played out with the actors taking on the roles of the mill workers from a bygone time, and it became more and more foreboding with every room we entered and walked through. Gradually, the play built in atmosphere until it became much more of a ghost story. I began to sing a song in one of the rooms, a creepy rhyme. I was immediately transported back to another scene from Sapphire and Steel set in a haunted house. There was a nursery rhyme involved, Ring Around the Rosie, which stemmed from the time of the plague, and when sung both backwards or forwards, made people disappear and clocks stop. This nursery rhyme will never be the same again, and from my memory of watching the programme, became in my eyes forever the focus for dark evil forces. The programme has totally changed my thoughts on it, and now six-year-olds aren't allowed to sing it ever. Far too scary. Give me a song from Frozen any day. Back at the mill, the play continued building momentum until the final scene where things I can't describe, as I really don't know what they were, started chasing us along a corridor to the door that led to the exit. I'm in no way a fast runner and was last to get to the door, escaping at the very last second with the ghostly actor's hands just missing me. I flew through the door, tripped, and brought down the couple in front magnificently in my panic. We lay in a heap on the floor wondering what had happened, with me apologising profusely. They did recover. Eventually. In my eyes, Sapphire and Steel has a very similar themes running through it to those of the most recent Doctor Who stories. I can see a lot of the new series in the programme, and whether that was meant to be, I don't know. But I always wonder if Stephen Moffat was a fan of Sapphire and Steel, especially with The Crack in Time and the Roman Centurions. Maybe the memory and influence of the programme manifested itself in his stories. There was so much unexplained in the last assignment of the series. It was left on a cliffhanger with Sapphire and Steel trapped in a cafe floating through space, the camera panning away, leaving them there for eternity, and you wanted so much more. I only wish there had been more written. Sapphire and Steel was up there with Doctor Who for me. It fascinated me, and I still talk about it to this day. It left such a huge impression. A brilliantly atmospheric series with strong characters. I especially loved the opening titles and hope that one day it might make a return. My love of ghost hunting programmes stemmed from the show, and if ever I have the opportunity to stay in the haunted house, I'm sure my imagination would completely run away with me. Do cracks in time really exist, and can dark malevolent forces get through? I don't know. I don't think so. I remain open-minded, but would not survive 2 minutes if I ever saw anything like the situation Sapphire and Steel encountered. My running shoes would be firmly on, and hopefully I wouldn't plough anyone down in the process of saving myself from impending doom.
You've been listening to You and Who Talking, presented by Rob Irwin with J.R. Southall. The You and Who books, from which all royalties are paid to charity, are available in print and for Kindle from watchingbooks.weebly.com.